This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 14th of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, an investigation reveals how the CIA is expanding its presence in Somalia with a new compound and a secret prison. We travel into Somalia and hear from former fighters with Al-Shabaab who've defected from the radical Islamic group. And Mumbai residents react to yesterday's bomb attacks. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, the UN General Assembly approved the world's newest country, the Republic of South Sudan, for membership in the United Nations. It becomes the 193rd UN member. And welcoming Africa's newest nation, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon stressed the country still needs to broker peace with its northern neighbor, Sudan, from which it seceded.
It is imperative that you resolve outstanding differences with the same pragmatism and leadership that you have each shown so far. The well-being and future prosperity of each depends on the other.
Secretary Ban went on to say to the citizens of South Sudan, "You now sit with us, we stand with you." The Vice President of South Sudan, Riek Machar Tenney, told the General Assembly his country takes its responsibility as a member seriously.
"We have a daunting agenda in front of us. We must first fulfill our responsibility to provide security and extend the rule of law."
North to the Middle East, efforts to create and admit the 194th nation into the UN is gaining momentum. The Arab League has thrown its weight behind Palestinian plans to petition the UN for recognition of statehood. The announcement comes in the same week that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas vowed to pursue the bid for statehood at the General Assembly this fall. Zach Brophy has this report from neighboring Lebanon.
In the face of a moribund peace process, Palestinian negotiators have made a gamble on unilaterally seeking official recognition of statehood at the UN General Assembly this coming September. The Arab League, a regional coalition of Arab nations, today gave its support to the Palestinian campaign. At a press conference, Secretary General Nabil Al Arab said the League would move to present a request for full membership of a Palestinian state in the General Assembly and the Security Council. The Palestinian plan is opposed by Israel, the US, and some European governments. Palestinians have refused to join direct peace talks since Israel resisted US and international pressure to extend a freeze on settlement construction in the occupied Palestinian territories. If successful, the new status would give Palestinians full member state recognition at the UN and greater access to international courts. The Palestinians already have the support of more than 112 nations, and they're banking on mounting international pressure to dissuade Washington from using its veto in the Security Council. Zach Brophy, FSRN, Beirut.
In Syria today, troubles continue for anti-government protesters. Two are dead after government security forces opened fire on a crowd in Deir al-Zor, a large city in the northeastern part of the country, according to Al Jazeera. This follows several other deaths last night in government crackdowns. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is expected to travel tomorrow to Turkey, a major regional force that has been trying to negotiate Syrian peace. Officials are expected to discuss the situation in Syria as well as Libya. Conditions for prisoners in Uganda are often appalling, according to a new Human Rights Watch report released today. Researcher Catherine Todry says prisoners are packed into cells and often denied medical treatment and are forced to work in slave-like conditions.
Sick prisoners are made to work for private landowners who pay the prison authorities, and they're made to work day after day. They're brutally beaten to make them work harder, and that's because the money goes to the prison authorities, because the prison authorities need that money to operate their prisons. They pocket some of it personally, and so the prisons have an incentive to push prisoners to work under backbreaking conditions, to brutally beat them, even when they're ill.
Researchers who visited 16 prisons around the country found that the HIV and tuberculosis rate among prisoners is double that of the regular population. Todry says 56% of prisoners in Ugandan jails have not been convicted of crimes, but instead are waiting for the court system to hear their cases. A new study shows a daily dose of anti-HIV medication can lessen the spread of HIV to women by more than 70%. The drug tenofovir, produced by the California pharmaceutical company Gilead Sciences Incorporated, has been shown to reduce HIV transmission risk in gay men as well. Dr. Catherine Harkins is UNAIDS chief scientific advisor.
This is exciting. It certainly helps with the goal that was signed on to at the high-level meeting and the political declaration in June to reduce sexual transmission by 50% by 2015. We've got our work cut out for us, but now we have an additional tool that can be used.
Last week, Gilead signed a deal with the medicine's patent pool, which allowed tenofovir to be produced cheaply and made available in many developing countries around the world. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Yemen today, a suspected U.S. drone strike on a police station taken over by militants killed at least six people. Witnesses told Al Jazeera the building was demolished and a half dozen bodies were identified, but more may have died or been injured. A Yemeni official denied it was a U.S. strike and claimed it was carried out by its own air force, according to Reuters. The U.S. has stepped up its drone program over the last few years, most notably in Pakistan. But strikes are also taking place in Somalia, a country we turn to now. An investigation in the capital Mogadishu by The Nation magazine and Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill reveals that the U.S. is expanding its covert operations there. Scahill's article, The CIA's Secret Sites in Somalia, reports that the CIA has a new base and is training a local force to fight the militant group Al-Shabaab. He's just got back from his 10-day trip. Welcome back to Free Speech Radio News.
It's great to be back.
Now, the CIA's new compound in Mogadishu, it was finished about 4 months ago, and it's located near the airport. How close did you get to it, and what's it like?
I actually was able to get very, very close to it. In fact, the facility is located inside the airport compound itself. And, I mean, I noticed it almost immediately upon arriving in the country, and saw that it seemed to be a newly constructed facility, started digging around and learned from very senior Somali officials that, in fact, it was a CIA counterterrorism training center. The ironic thing about the notion of it being secret is that what we learned is that almost everyone in Mogadishu knows that the CIA had set up shop at the airport. So it's a very poorly held secret by the CIA.
And you also found out that the CIA uses a secret prison in the basement of Somalia's National Security Agency headquarters, and you spoke to some senior Somali intelligence officials and former prisoners about what goes on there. What did they tell you?
Well, my understanding from both former prisoners and the senior officials in Somalia that I spoke to is that there are scores of people being held in this underground prison that is, my understanding is, infested with bedbugs, mosquitoes. There are people that are literally losing their mind there, some of whom have been held for a year and a half without charge or access to any lawyers or Red Cross, and that they never see the light of day. Many of the people that are held there are believed to have some connection to the Islamic militant group Al-Shabaab, which has close ties to Al-Qaeda. And the U.S. CIA and potentially military intelligence personnel that work with the Somalis in that facility are permitted to interrogate prisoners when they want. Though when I spoke to the U.S. official made available to me for this story, they said it's only happened on rare occasions and only jointly with the Somalis. That was directly contradicted when I asked Somali officials who work at the prison as well as former prisoners. They said that white people interrogate prisoners alone all the time.
Among the men believed to be held in this prison is Ahmed Abdullahi Hassan, who's a 26-year-old Kenyan citizen who disappeared from a Somali slum in Nairobi a couple of years ago. Can you tell us just a little bit more about his case?
Yeah, this was a man who U.S. intelligence identified as the right-hand man to a man named Ali Nabhan, who was wanted by the U.S. For questioning in connection with his alleged role in a series of bombings inside of Kenya in 2002, and also possible links to the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. And what a U.S. official told me was that the United States provided intelligence to the Kenyans that was then used to snatch this guy and render him to Mogadishu. The U.S. says we didn't render him, but they don't dispute that the Kenyans rendered him and that they did so with the help of U.S. Intelligence. This man was then brought to Somalia, and 2 months after he was snatched, Ali Nabhan, the guy who the U.S. said he was the right-hand man to, was killed in the first targeted strike inside of Somalia that we know of that was authorized directly by President Barack Obama. So it seems as though the U.S. is making use of this prison to extract information from people that would be determined to be high-value targets.
One of the latest drone attacks that happened in Somalia just a few weeks ago targeted these al-Shabaab militants. What did you learn about the CIA's drone program in Somalia?
Right. I mean, when we're talking about these attacks, either by drone or helicopter, they're generally being done by the Joint Special Operations Command, the most elite unit within the U.S. military, the people that killed Osama bin Laden. And they're striking outside of Mogadishu in rural areas of the country. And the pattern that is sort of developing is that they do a strike either by drone, that could be operated by the CIA or JSOC, or by some other means, launching a missile or doing a helicopter attack. And then the JSOC troops enter Somalia, land on the ground, and recover the bodies and take them either for matching their DNA to suspects, or in the case of those that are alive, holding them prisoner, sometimes on U.S. naval ships off the coast of Somalia, as a recent case indicated.
The physical destruction in the city of Mogadishu is very clear from the slideshow and images taken by Richard Rowley that accompany your report. How widespread is this type of destruction?
I was horrified at what I saw in Mogadishu. There's no state, there's no government. Whole neighborhoods reek of rotting flesh. Animals wander around chewing trash. There are mass graves, decapitated bodies in the Shabaab areas that have been retaken by the government forces and the African Union forces backed by the United States. Bullets just randomly fly into courtyards of people's homes. In fact, one night we were sitting in the courtyard of the small house we were staying in, and a bullet flew into the courtyard in the middle of the night and just hit the back of the chair of a man we were talking to. And all of the Somalis just kind of looked and brushed it off because they're used to it. People are basically being left to suffer in the midst of an escalating war and the worst famine and drought in at least 60 years in East Africa. It's a categorical disaster that's being made worse, I fear, by U.S. policy, particularly the military policy that we're engaged in now.
Jeremy Scahill, correspondent for The Nation magazine and Democracy Now!, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
While the Somali government forces, backed by the U.S. and African Union troops, continue their war, there are indications al-Shabaab might also be struggling internally. Although recruitment of more fighters continues, a growing number are defecting. FSRN's Mohamed Yusuf recently met with former insurgents and brings us their stories.
5 years ago, 20-year-old Kismayu resident Mohamed Farah was with the local clan militia in Lower Juba, southern Somalia. But he joined al-Shabaab after the insurgent group took over his coastal city. He said he had no other choice if he wanted to stay in his hometown.
In Somalia today, the only life for people is either carrying a gun, ready for a fight, or running away. If you don't join either of the warring groups, then you are forced to leave the country.
For many young men in Somalia, including Farah, joining warring groups is the only way to survive and to make a living in a country that's gone through decades of warfare and poverty. Others have been targeted at school, including 19-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim, who lived in a remote village in southern Gedo region. When al-Shabaab came there to recruit fighters, his entire class joined.
The reason I joined the group was all my friends, classmates, and people who were around me joined al-Shabaab. They became fighters and started carrying weapons.
Ibrahim fought with al-Shabaab for 3 years when their base was attacked by a militia allied to the government. He was hit in the head by a stray bullet. Ibrahim said he became disillusioned with life in the bush and with al-Shabaab.
I had to leave al-Shabaab. I came to know them better after working with them for a couple years. When you work with them, you'll get to know them better. Al-Shabaab has become a group that has isolated itself from the whole country and beyond. They think the whole country belongs to them. And when you work for them, you are someone who is not free. You can't do anything.
In the areas under al-Shabaab control, people with incomes and business owners must pay them a tax of about $2,000 a year. Those who cannot pay are forced to join the fight against the Western-backed government. Many businessmen who pay the yearly tax have criticized al-Shabaab for failing to circulate the money locally and invest in development. 30-year-old Abduwali was a businessman in Bakool region in central Somalia before he joined al-Shabaab. Like hundreds of others, business owners Well, he said he didn't have enough money to pay Al-Shabaab's fees.
I had a shop when Al-Shabaab reached our area and started taking control. They blocked roads that were used to supply goods to our area, especially roads from Mogadishu and Baidoa. I couldn't get any supplies, and that's how I lost my business.
Wali said he was unemployed for a year when a colleague who joined Al-Shabaab helped to recruit him. He told Wali he will be taught Islam and paid good money. Wali weighed his options and decided to join. He was taken to a training camp for 6 months, where he trained with more than 300 newly recruited Al-Shabaab fighters from different parts of the country. Wali said they were taught weapon assembly, its usage, and how to put together explosives. No one left the camp, except for those who were ready to be deployed to the battlefield.
One day there was a fight in the camp, and after that fight, I heard someone firing his gun. He was one of our trainers, and shouting, "God is great! God is great!" Honestly, I was shocked. He was not leading us by good example. A lot of things came to my mind. After deep consideration, I came to realize that the people who we were fighting against, they were fellow Muslims.
During his 10-month stay with Al-Shabaab, while his family pressured him to leave the group, opposition to Al-Shabaab was growing across Somalia, and the US and the UN-backed government began an offensive to oust the group. Al-Shabaab's poor wages were also becoming a problem.
For 10 months of fighting, Al-Shabaab paid me $100. My family and relatives were pressuring me 24 hours a day to leave the group, and there was no way I could convince them that I should stay. I had to leave.
Both Farah and Wali say they are done with the fighting. They just want to return to ordinary life. Ibrahim says he wants to continue his studies. But their immediate outlook is bleak. They will be sent to the northeastern Kenya and the Dadaab refugee camp, the largest in the world. More than 370,000 Somalis are seeking refuge here, in a camp that was built 20 years ago to only house 90,000. Mohamed Yusuf, Efosoren, Elwak, Somalia.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. In Mumbai yesterday, three well-coordinated attacks struck India's commercial capital. According to the latest government reports, the attack has left 18 dead and more than 100 injured. Terror attacks on the city have claimed more than 700 lives since 1993. FSRN's Gayatri Lakshimbai was near the blast sites in south and central Mumbai and spoke with residents about the attack.
How should I feel? I feel really bad. Those who shouldn't have died helplessly. Do you get me? That's not a good thing at all. Businesses have been affected badly. All the shops by the blast site have been shut since morning. The police and media people have surrounded the area in such a way that people can't move around. There's a lot of inconvenience. The roads are shut. All this is really bad. Nothing good about it.
I'm so sad to say this, but yeah, I do not know how to react to it. It's happened again, and it will happen again. So the fact that we are getting used to it, that it's becoming a routine, that people will now be okay with the ideas of any bomb blast happening at any other street, is what worries me the most. Rather than going for rallies and protesting against it and all of that anger, I think that just getting okay with the idea of another bomb blast is worrying me the most.
It doesn't feel right, but I still am very indifferent about it. Even today morning when I see the city is working as normal, it's like nothing happened. Everybody just taking it in their stride, and I'm not saying that they're taking it in their stride because it's not because they want to show the terrorists or whoever planted the bombs or did the blast that we cannot be subdued or anything. It's just because they have no other choice. Otherwise, they'll lose out on a day's pay or maybe their jobs or maybe their clients at some level. Even the anger that I see amongst people is not towards the blast so much, but towards the authorities that who are not being able to know about them beforehand and do something about it.
My initial reaction after I heard that there has been a bomb blast was that of fear. Everybody was scared. There were horrid scenes on TV, and we heard of terrible tales of heads and limbs flying everywhere. People were then rushed to the hospital. Today I am much better, but there's still a fear. I feel as though some more is to follow.
Maybe the police by themselves are, it's maybe harsh to say that they are to blame, but the entire intelligence operation of a country as vast as India is definitely not in place when this is a repeated thing. It happens at a very, very disgusting regularity, like 13 and 20 years. So that kind of puts you off. It leads you to believe that they're not really serious about what they're doing, and which is why some things like this are happening repeatedly.
That we are a little fed up, but then, you know, we have to work. And now it's like we are part of it, you know, it's a part of a system where, okay, you know, you're there, you're not there. But nobody's going to stop working. So everybody's going to step onto the road, to the street, to the offices. And today it's become like, you know, we're pretty immune to the whole thing now.
You heard Mumbai residents C.P. Tiwari, Ruchita Raichi, Dhiren Talpaid, Akul Tripathi, Manju Saul, and Prashant Mehta responding to yesterday's terrorist attacks. This segment was recorded and produced by FSRN's Gayatri Lakshimbai. Today, Israeli warplanes hit an underground tunnel on the Gaza-Egypt borderline, wounding 4 people. Right after this attack, a newly formed Gaza group calling itself Palestine Brigades fired a homemade rocket on nearby Israeli areas, but no one was injured and it caused no property damage. The violence follows attacks today and yesterday by the Israeli Navy, which fired water cannons at an international human rights group monitoring Palestinian fishermen. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
Civil Peace Service Gaza says Israeli warships directed water cannons at their boat Olivia when they were less than 2 nautical miles from the coast. The boat was heading to document the warship's harassment of Palestinian fishing boats nearby. Rukaya Al-Samarai is a British citizen and representative for the group. She says the attack is the first in 6 weeks.
The role is to make sure that anything that happens is documented, because often you'll find that A, something that happens in Gaza isn't documented, and B, something that happens off the coast of Gaza, nobody's there to witness. So these things happen literally on a daily basis. Fishermen are shot at with guns, with bullets, with water cannons, as we experienced today as well.
Since 2006, Israel has enforced a no-fishing zone of the Gaza Strip coast, except for within a 3 nautical mile limit. This has negatively affected the fishing industry in the region, where fish is a main source of a protein for Gaza's 1.6 million residents. Mahfoud Al-Kabariti is director for the Gaza Strip's Fishermen's Society.
There are other professions that are connected with the fishing industry. These include the vans, the maintenance, the ice providers, the nets industry, and the mechanics. I can say that there are more than 70,000 people who are connected directly or indirectly to fishing, and these people have been badly affected.
The boat Olivia started its monitoring mission in early June. Crew members say they were also harassed today after an Israeli warship again fired water cannons, nearly filling the boat with water. Crew members had to be rescued, as the boat was in danger of capsizing. The CPSG is an international group funded by dozens of local and international organizations and involves activists from Italy, Sweden, the US, and UK. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Negotiations over raising the nation's debt ceiling are still at an impasse, and many lawmakers are now offering their legislative responses in case of a default. Matt Laszlo reports on the twists and turns of the debate in Washington.
Earlier this week, the top Republican in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, announced a backup plan to potentially give President Obama the power to raise the debt limit without an up or down vote in Congress. The plan would allow members to vote to disapprove raising the debt ceiling, but would give the president the power to override it with a veto. Under the parliamentarian maneuver, the president would be granted power to raise the debt limit if he promised to cut the budget significantly. The plan is being coolly received in both parties. Here's Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn.
Political answer to a policy problem.
Minority Leader McConnell admitted as much on a radio talk show Wednesday by saying if Republicans allow a default, voters would blame them for the bad economy, and it would help the president's chances of re-election. On Wednesday evening, White House negotiations soured even further, as tempers reportedly flared between the president and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Here's how a visibly flushed Cantor recounted the end of the meeting.
Now, the White House meeting just ended, and it ended with the president abruptly walking out of the meeting.
Reports have come out that Cantor was the one who kept talking over the president as Obama tried to end the meeting. Republican leaders still say they won't accept a single tax increase as a part of a deal. And rank-and-file Democrats have pushed away from the president's compromise plan to cut $4 trillion from the deficit, including cuts to entitlements. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham offers this bleak assessment of where the talks are headed.
I think what's going to happen is we won't raise the debt ceiling.
In his scenario, Graham says he thinks after policymakers fail to raise the debt limit, then both parties will come together and pass something.
There'll be a market reaction, then people will get really serious about what to do.
But the consequences of not raising the debt limit could be dire. Moody's Investors Service says it's contemplating lowering the U.S. credit rating to AA if the debt limit isn't raised in the next couple weeks. If the nation defaults, economists say the cost of the dollar would go down, along with stock prices. New York Senator Chuck Schumer describes default like this.
A default would pull the rug out from each and every family in this country for no good reason. It is the American dream to continually climb that ladder towards prosperity. But defaulting on our debt would be voluntarily hanging an anchor around the neck of each and every family.
Earlier this week, President Obama also said he couldn't guarantee that Social Security checks would go out if the nation defaults on its debt obligations. That led to a flurry of legislative responses being offered on Capitol Hill. Some lawmakers introduced bills to protect seniors first if the money gets tight. Others want the military to be funded first. Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons says all are bad options.
But these sorts of choices, these choices that would require us week in and week out, the Treasury Department to pick winners and losers to decide which bills we wouldn't pay in order to avoid default, strike me as nearly catastrophic.
Coons says there are consequences that go beyond the U.S. borders, too.
Frankly, the larger consequence is roiling the financial markets globally. We are the world's leading economy. And the idea that we are being mentioned in the same sentence around the world with Greece, with Ireland, with Italy, with countries that are either on the verge of default or have defaulted is stunning to me.
Democrats are now calling on Leader Cantor to not just attempt to forge a coalition within his own party. They say for any deal to pass, he needs to reach out to House Democrats, too. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
And that's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.